Welcome to Special Sauce, a Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
It's bigger than that. Like, I'm creating jobs for people that look like me. I'm giving them a safe place to work, somewhere where they can create their ideas, some place where they get an opportunity and a chance.
This week, we are back with Chef J.J. Johnson, co-author of Between Harlem and Heaven, Afro-Asian American Cooking for Big Nights, Weeknights, and Every Day. It's a lot of subtitle, man. That is a lot of subtitle. Can I say that?
We wanted to relate to everybody.
Between Harlem and Heaven. Why that name?
There was, I think the New Yorker or the Observer wrote a review about us at the Cecil, and they said this reminded them of heaven. And we were like, well, Harlem then equals heaven. And so that, between Harlem and heaven, like, you can cook the food that brings you, you can be in Harlem and you can get this food that brings you to heaven.
And so break down the subtitle, Afro-Asian American Cooking for Big Nights, Weeknights, and Every Day.
So the Afro part is the food of the African diaspora. We're touching on food from West Africa and how forced migration has gone into the Caribbean, into South America, and then into the American South. The Asian part of it is the Asian migrant workers that came along with the West African slaves. And you get those cooking notes through the dishes. And then the American is things that, for Alexander, have hit the American South, that are home for him.
And Big Nights, Weeknights, and Every Day is just so you know that this cookbook is for all occasions.
Yeah, I mean, like, some people have big nights, and listen, let's throw down. Every day, there's things for every day, and on weekends for long cooking.
Got it. So why did you decide that it was time to write a cookbook?
It was like, you know, let's do a book that represents who we are and the food we cook. And there's really nothing really out there that represents the African-American culture, mm-hmm. and who they are and where they come from and the makeup
right.
of the food.
The diversity of the African.
Right.
And all the different inputs.
Exactly. And that voice, right? And the book, a book takes much longer than I think people realize. And some people think, oh, you wrote a book yesterday, not published?
I've written a few books that
take
a really long time. And you think that even when you turn it in that it's over.
So, yeah, I mean, we started
just beginning,
right. So we started this in about 2014. My voice through the book is, you know, through the food. Alexander's voice through the book is the history.
And the overarching concept.
Exactly. And we were like, who can help merge this together? And we brought a brilliant writer in, Veronica Chambers, that could really bring our voices out, you know, the emotional voice and bring it factual.
Yeah, and she wrote her own book. She's written her own books, and she also co-wrote Marcus Samuelson's memoir,
right.
Yes Chef.
And Eric Repair's memoir too,
right.
100 Yo.
Both of whom have been on Special Sauce.
Right. And I think now looking back in the state we are, and there's so much talks about migration and people coming into the country and people thinking they're going one place, but now they're going somewhere else, that changes the culinary landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best place to kind of look at that is like with Canada. And the culinary landscape is just changing there. And 150 years from now, you'll look back and say, oh, my God, where did these flavors come from? And they're merging with these other cultures.
Right.
And that's what we're really, you know, showing through the book. And I felt like it was just time to have a voice bigger than just being in a restaurant.
You were just tired of spending 14 hours a day in a place that nobody could see you.
Exactly.
You didn't want to be invisible anymore. So describe the process of writing the book.
I spent three months with Veronica, 2 days a week.
And what would she do? Turn the tape recorder on?
She would,
ask
yeah.
you questions?
So 2 days a week, she would turn on the tape recorder. She had a list of questions. We would kind of go back and forth through these questions. And that's how we were able to pull out some of the essays, some of the writing, some of the quotes.
Some of the head notes.
Head notes, right. While we're doing the head notes, I pulled out 100 recipes, which I think represented the book. And then from there was like, well, how can we take these 100 recipes and make sure people can make them at home?
Right.
Right. And I think that that's a great thing we do through the book. You can see some recipes where we say you can use this chili, but in the store you might not be able to get it, so you can use this.
And then you had people to test the recipes, or did you test them yourself?
So then what I did was I did have somebody test the recipes. But when we shot the book, I was there as a, I managed the photo team, and I let them cook and plate. Because what I plate in the restaurant is totally different than
sure
what should come across in the book. So I learned about plating and how making things beautiful for a book. And then I gave the recipes to a recipe writer and a recipe tester.
Wow, man. There's a lot of chefs in this kitchen.
Right. And I kind of let everybody do what they could do really great. And we all tested the recipes at home. We gave them to family members because I really want the recipes to really work for you. I just don't want them to be in the book. And when you try them out, you're cursing me out saying these don't work. So, yeah, I have amazing recipe tester, amazing recipe writer, and, you know, really pulled the book together with Flatiron and McMillan.
If someone was going to start with three recipes in the book, what would you want them to start by making?
So the Brussels sprout recipe is something you could do today.
Okay.
It's like four ingredients.
What are the four ingredients?
Man, you're about to make me start. I think it's Brussels sprouts, orange zest, bird's eye chili, and maple syrup.
Okay.
So it's like this spicy, citrusy, sweet. You just caramelize them on your stovetop. If you're looking for something for a long weekend, you can get guinea hen or chicken.
Okay.
And you can put it in the cinnamon brine and let that sit on a Friday and then fry it off on a Saturday, which you get this beautiful cinnamon scented chicken or guinea hen. And if you wanted to do something like really fun with your kids, I would do the oxtail dumpling recipe. And you could do that with short ribs. You can do that with chicken that's left over. So there are some areas where you could substitute with your leftovers. Build this filling. You don't have to make the dumplings from scratch. You can buy the dumpling wrappers in your store. And then you can have your kids like fold the dumplings, and we give you a small tutorial in the book.
If I remember, you served those oxtail dumplings at that Esquire party.
Yes, I did.
See, I have a very good food memory.
That's great.
And they were serious, man.
Thank you
very much. I just
want
to tell you.
Thank you.
You just came off a stint as the first chef in residence at the Chef's Club in New York City.
Yeah.
And we should tell people that the Chef's Club is sort of has a rotating chef's concept that they bring in people, chefs, to develop menu items for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But they don't necessarily cook there. They may stay there long enough that the team in place at Chef's Club can execute the dishes. But you actually took it a step further. You were like there cooking food every night.
Yeah, I was there cooking food every night. I mean, I just left Cecil and Minton's in June. It was what I felt time to really spread my wings and have a major impact on the culinary world. And I got asked to, you know, I was working on my own concept, which is a rice concept.
And that's what you're doing now.
That's what I'm doing now. But I was at Chef's Club counter. We tested out the rice concept. It went really well. And then the owner said, hey, I'm about to do this new residency program. Would you like to do this? My mind was so focused on this counter restaurant concept that we have. And now to go back to full service, what can I do? So I will always cook the food of the African diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
So I just included some, you know, hip-hop, R&B, 90s hip-hop and R&B. And
there's a theme here.
Right. Some food that I kind of stopped cooking when I was at the Cecil, but people would always ask me for. So, you know, brought some of those dishes back, worked on some new dishes, and really took it at the helm. Like, this was my restaurant. This is what I would do if this was a full-service restaurant. Tapped a sous chef that worked with me before for a short period of time, Samantha Davis, who was really great. I need somebody that was slightly more organized than I was.
Uh-huh.
And I could just focus on flavor and training. And we really rocked it out. I was only supposed to be there a month. I wound up doubling their sales in 2 weeks. And we rocked all the way out to the end of the year. And I could physically say to anybody that I could put butts in seats.
Right.
And I can fill a restaurant.
That's great. Tell me about some things that were on the menu that people were really turned on by.
So I did this, and I'm obsessed with rice. So I did this dish called Concon in Dominican restaurant you go to in the hood. You get the bottom of the crispy rice, which they call concon.
Right. In paella, it's called socorro.
Socorro, right. So every culture has it. So what I did was I took some sticky rice, and I made coconut lime sticky rice. And on the La Plancha, we would make concon.
The plancha, we should say, is a stovetop griddle that's used extensively in Spanish cooking.
In Spanish cooking, right. So I took very strong advantage of that at Chef's Club. And what I did was typically I would make this jollof rice, which is just a spicy tomato-based rice, and I made that into an eggplant curry. And that was our number one selling dish. It was $12. So you got this crispy coconut rice.
Ooh, sounds really delicious.
Spicy tomato-based eggplant curry with some radishes on top. We would do these oversized Flintstone bone short ribs that were braised in like cinnamon sticks and orange juice and veal stock. And it would come with some house-made kimchi, some house-made roti.
And you would leave the short rib whole.
Whole on the bone. Glazed with hoisin peanut
barbecue.
Yeah,
so we're talking about like a foot long.
Yeah, two of them. So you would get them to share.
Yeah, you better.
From Nyman Ranch. So it wasn't like we were skimping on food costs.
Yeah.
So that was a big hit. And I would say my favorite of all-time favorite was our goat noodles. So just some udon noodles, whole braised goat, some pickled red onions, some crushed peanuts, and this West African peanut sauce that really would hit home or give you everything in one dish.
And didn't you get, like, I don't know, I kept reading I happened to read all three New York papers every day, and I would read about, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z, like, you attracted this celebrity-driven crowd, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really, you know, I have to thank, truly, truly thank everybody in the food world and out the food world because the support really came out. Like, you know, Steph Curry and Aisha Curry came in, and I just happened to know their marketing director who was like, yo, I'm bringing them through. And I was like, yeah, okay, man. And Jerron Smith, who's a 30 under 30 guy with me. Ashley Graham came in for New Year's. Brian Gumbel. One of the band leaders from Aventura, like, I mean, every night was coming in. Somebody was coming in. Eddie Murphy's ex-wife came in. So every night or every week, we were having, like, an A-list celebrity come in.
Wow.
And I think it was different. It was just like, we need to support this rising chef on the rise, and we hear the food's really good, and the music is supposed to be amazing.
That's awesome. So if I met Steph Curry, I would challenge him to a game of horse. Why are you laughing?
Because, you know, horse, you're out. Like, I don't know.
Because you know I'd get my ass kicked. But wouldn't it be fun to play horse with Steph Curry?
It would be fun to play horse with Steph Curry.
Because, you know, he'd do some shit that you couldn't do in your wildest dreams.
He'd shoot from the bleachers.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like this, and he'd be flicking it in the back of his head.
No, I wouldn't. I would say I'll challenge you to horse, and then let's go in the kitchen, and I'll challenge you to something in the kitchen.
To make the oxtail dumplings.
Exactly.
So tell us a little bit more about this concept you're developing.
I've been working with Glenn Roberts from a conceptual standpoint on heirloom grains in the world.
Uh-huh.
Or not even heirloom.
And who's Glenn Roberts?
Glenn Roberts is the owner of Anson Mills.
Okay.
I don't even want to say heirloom grains. I'm going to say origins of grains.
Uh-huh.
So origin mother grains from the world or rice grains from around the world. And everywhere from in the world, there's a mother grain that represents that culture. And Glenn just happens to have about three of those grains that he's developed, rice grains that he's developed.
Uh-huh.
And everywhere I've traveled over the last 5 years, rice has been the center of the table. So I've been to Singapore, I've been to Israel, I've been to India. And I've just developed a concept around rice. So when you're thinking about it, you're thinking about a ramen noodle shop, think of a rice shop. And you're going to have four or five different rices prepared different ways. There'll be a dumpling, there'll be some roti, two salads, order from the counter. And it'll feel like you're at the Caribbean beach, but the vibe will give you 80s and 90s New York City.
Got it.
So like super green graffiti with 90s music.
So there's going to be a lot of New Jack Swing.
New Jack Swing, you got it. See, it brings everybody somewhere. But the dishes would have like, you know, we think about rice, we think about forbidden black rice. It would have, you know, emperor's black rice. You think about risotto, we would have rice porridge made with Italian astrology. You think about, you know, there's a West African mother grain called Glamorema that they're growing in Mississippi right now. You know, we would have a jasmine rice.
So your mother must be happy because you turn out to be a keen student. You just weren't cut out to go to graduate school at Harvard, but you have a great deal of intellectual curiosity.
You know, my mom was one of my editors, what I call in my book. I sent her the book, and she highlighted and called some things out that I missed. So yeah, we've worked together. She's worked with me in the process of the cookbook over this last year. So yeah, my mom has been very big place mark in my life right now.
Yeah, that's great. So what other goals, sort of short and long term, do you have? Like what stuff like that in your wildest imagination you'd like to be doing sometime over in the next 10 years?
I would say my ultimate goal. I said on another podcast that I dreamed about being like Michael Jordan of the industry, or I dreamed about being like this chef, right? You'll hear me mention like people I dreamed about. But now like I wake up every day, maybe because I have children that are 5 months.
Congratulations, you have twins that are 5 months.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're totally sleep deprived.
No, grandmas.
Right.
but I think, and not to go off topic, but I believe that the impact through what we did, and what me and Alexander did in the last 4 years at the Cecil has opened the doors for a lot of people to feel okay with themselves about what they cook.
Right.
And I think now with myself cooking and keep pushing and doing things, hopefully around the country, cooking for Grammys Week here in New York City at Spring Place, that everybody just doesn't want French and Italian food anymore.
Right.
And I would say that has been on my list as something that I would hope to break down that barrier.
Got it. So that your food from the African diaspora
Correct.
Would become mainstream.
Correct. And, you know, people would want it every day, or we would show the people that control the industry, or I would show people that control the industry, that people do want this food every day.
Yeah.
That the food of the African diaspora.
Yeah.
But I would say long-term goal, like ultimate, like checkbox for me would probably have like my own Nike sneaker.
Okay.
Or like a Reebok or Adidas, something like that, or Under Armour.
So it all gets back to Steph Curry.
Steph. Maybe we do a brand of sneaker together.
All right.
Short-term goal is my own restaurant, like a flagship where you can come see me every day. And then I would say big goal is just developing the JJ brand around the world where you could hopefully eat my food in the bottom of a hotel or in a mall or on a rest stop. Because what I'm doing is just not putting JJ or the name of my restaurant somewhere, for me, is bigger than that. Like, I'm creating jobs for people that look like me.
Right.
I'm giving them a safe place to work, somewhere where they can create their ideas, some place where they get an opportunity and a chance.
You'd want to mentor people in your own, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm mentoring kids now. I call everybody a kid, even if you're older than me, I still call you a kid.
You can call me a kid.
But yeah, I mean, I'm very fortunate. I look at my Instagram every day. Somebody's reaching out to me for some type of advice. And I try to make sure I respond to everybody. Like, I didn't have anybody that mentored me. I had my father.
Right.
Like, and what is he going to tell me about food? He's telling me about life, or my grandfather, my uncles.
Right.
You know, I was happy that my uncle was what he calls himself, a half of a cook. But, you know, my uncle owned a crab boat. So he was very into food. So at least I had that.
Sure.
But, you know, I reached out to a lot of chefs in my career that never responded back.
Yeah, interesting.
You know? So I make sure that for myself now in my career, that if somebody does reach out to me, I respond back. And if I can't help you, I say I can port you in the right direction. But I try to respond to everybody. And if I haven't responded to you, I truly apologize.
All right. Now it's time for the special sauce all you can answer buffet. We don't have a clock, so you can take as long as you want to answer the questions. And there'll be no gong. So who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Could be living, dead, artists.
Only one person?
No. Four. You have at least four places. You could even have five if you can come up with them.
I have to have Barack and Michelle.
Okay, that's two.
Right. I have to have Martin Luther King.
Uh-huh.
I would have to have Van Gogh.
Van Gogh. I'm liking this table. Van Gogh, Michelle, and Barack Obama.
Martin Luther King,
and you've got one more.
And I've been watching The Crown, so Queen Elizabeth.
All right,
she's
I like
boss.
It.
I like really like her style.
All right, that sounds good. So what are you eating?
I think the table has banana leaves on them. It's family style. There's rice there. Probably like a whole roasted pig.
Okay, I like this.
You know, I definitely have some coconut sticky rice I would cook. We'd have some braised collard greens, coconut sticky rice, whole braised pig, even some fried fish, hot sauce.
Ooh, this is sounding really tasty. I hope you might save a spot for me.
I got you all anytime. And I love making like red bliss potatoes that you boil and then toss with butter and parsley.
Wow. What's your guilty pleasure? Do you have a guilty pleasure? You know, like
New York City pizza.
New York City pizza. But not the dollar slices. You want good New York City pizza.
Like Ray's, like Mama's Pizza by my house.
Have you ever had the slices at Patsy's on First Avenue?
First Avenue, yeah.
That's a coal-fired brick oven slice.
Exactly.
That's a serious slice.
So like good. That's my guilty pleasure.
Okay. And there's nothing to feel guilty about, by the way. What do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat? You come home, you've just had a long day at work. What are you making?
I'm a cast iron pan guy, so like I always have at least a sirloin or a ribeye in my fridge that I can just put on the cast iron pan, let it go really nice. I love broccoli, some broccoli like sautéed with garlic and a little chili oil. And those potatoes.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. That's pretty ambitious for when you don't have anything else in the house to eat.
Yeah. I mean, if not, then there's always some type of rice in the house, and it would just be cooking the rice, throwing some vegetables. There's always pesto in my fridge.
So who do you imagine you could acquire the most wisdom from at a one-on-one lunch?
If there was one person I could say I can acquire the most wisdom from, from a one-on-one lunch, I would probably say Patrick Clark.
Patrick Clark, who was the chef at Tavern on the Green and was the first, was a seminal African-American chef in New York,
yeah,
right?
I mean,
Alexander was around too, but Patrick was the first one to win James Beard Awards and that kind of thing,
right? He was also the highest paid chef without endorsements too at that time.
Right,
you know?
Right. So people don't understand that. And the reason was because he was the chef at Tavern on the Green, which was doing whatever it was, 2,000 covers a day. And he was the only chef who tamed that kitchen.
Right.
He got 2 stars, I think, from the Times, or maybe 3. And that's really hard to do, as Jeremiah Tower found out.
Right, 100%. 100%, yeah. So I think from a one-on-one standpoint, I think he could give me great knowledge in the industry.
Yeah, and I only met him a few times, and he was a really interesting, commanding figure.
Yeah.
You know, and
I'm very close friends with Preston Clark, who's his son.
Right, who was also a chef, right?
Yeah. At Lore.
Yeah, at the Lore Fish Bar. Yeah, I've met him. So, okay, this is really going to be fun for you. It's just been declared J.J. Johnson Day all over the world. What's happening on that day?
Well, I'm all about bringing people together, and I'm all about fun.
Okay.
So we wouldn't be watching anything about me on television.
Okay.
Every nightclub or bar in New York City would be your destination to go.
Okay, even during the day?
During the day.
So the bars and restaurants would open at 8 a.m.?
8 a.m.
Okay.
Everybody coming in would get the JJ shot.
Okay. What's the JJ shot?
Probably some bourbon.
Okay.
And you would just listen to music all day. You would party. And you would just remember, life is good. Celebrate. You're only here but so long.
I like it. So it would just be one big party.
One big
party. From 8 a.m. on.
It might flood into the streets. But
right.
Yeah, from 8 a.m. on to the next day. But you got to get to work the next day. You can't call out because I don't want to be blamed for losing your job.
All right. That sounds good, man. Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, J.J. Johnson. Really, it's been a pleasure. Serious Eaters, do check out J.J.'s book, Between Harlem and Heaven. And please do let us know, J.J., where you'll be cooking next. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters. Thank you, J.J.
Thank you very much for having me.